Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, people in Chapel Hill have a love affair with the Outer Banks. You'll see them streaming out of Chapel Hill in the summertime just to reach their favorite places. You'll hear them complaining when they get back that it's not the way that it used to be. And so we like people who will tell us both the way that it used to be and the way that it's going. And I'm delighted to welcome Ray McAllister, whose new book, Hatteras Island, Keeper of the Outer Banks, talks, I don't know, Ray, I don't want to say it tells it all, because it's not meant to be a comprehensive book, but it's a great kind of, it's a conversation about Hatteras Island. And thanks for writing the book, and thanks for coming to talk to us in Chapel Hill about it.
Well, my pleasure, DJ. DG, thanks for having me on. In fact, I call it a conversation with the island. It's parts history, parts a little bit of travelogue. It's certainly not a travel guide, so don't rush out thinking it's that. It talks about the island today. It talks about the island yesterday, about the people of the island. And the title, Keeper of the Outer Banks, I tried to capture what the book is about. First, it alludes historically back to the keepers of the lighthouse and the keepers of the lightship and the keepers of the life-saving station. So there's a historical tie, but it's also it's closer to the Outer Banks that you and I and most of your listeners remember. I first saw the Nag's Head area in the early 70s. I didn't see Hatteras until the early 80s. And by that time, the whole Kitty Hawk, Kill Devil Hills, Nag's Head area was changing. I mean, it's inevitable. All these places change. But Hatteras has changed less so for a variety of reasons.
Mm. Well, the reason that stuck out at me, other than a little bit of additional remoteness, a little bit of extra time to get there, is the presence of the National Seashore. And you tell that story very nicely. It wasn't without controversy.
No, it wasn't and isn't without controversy. It is, I think, perhaps the most defining element of Hatteras now, along with the geography, I guess. It is, as you say, so remote. If you look at a map, Hatteras is not part of North Carolina. There's an illusion that it is.
You're making a heretical statement, but you back it up and then explain it.
If I digress here, there is a Civil War portion there where Hatteras was Union. They both tended to side with Union and actually were overtaken during the war. But it's part of the Atlantic Ocean. If you look at a map, it's in the middle of the ocean, practically. It is very far from the mainland, especially out there by the Cape, the elbow of Hatteras Island. And it's not for nothing they call that the graveyard of the Atlantic out there.
It is, as you, again, you taught me a lot, that the, not the lighthouse itself, I guess it's Buxton or near Buxton, or maybe it's Rodanthe. One of those places is the furthest point east in the southern part of the United States.
Mm-hmm. That's the fishing pier up in Rodanthe.
Yeah,
which was featured in Knights in Rodanthe. It's new claim to fame.
Well, our friend Mr. Sparks has made us famous all over the world, and that's another feature of the Outer Banks, I guess, is that it's full of literature, of mythology, of pirates, of the kinds of things that spark literature. How did you? You're a Virginian. You're a newspaper columnist.
You say that as if it's a bad word.
It's a bad word.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
And it's and now editor of a magazine in Richmond. I mean, we're thrilled that you're spotlighting North Carolina, but how did a Virginian come to fall in love with North Carolina and write not only this book about Hatteras, but you've got earlier books about Topsail Island and also about Wrightsville Beach?
Well, I think it probably goes back as much as anything to my parents. They live in Wilmington, and one thing leads to another, and we vacationed on Topsail. Loved the place, loved Topsail Island. wrote a newspaper column. I was writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. It got way more response than you would figure for a column. I mean, people fell in love with Topsail, fell in love with the column, said I should write a book. One thing led to another. I did. It did very well. Sold a lot of copies. Won awards. My publisher, Winston-Salem, John F. Blair Publisher, great publishing house, wanted another book. We talked about Wrightsville Beach, and again, this is very near where my parents lived, and we had often gone there with the children for the day. So that was the second book, though that's entirely different than Topsail, much different place. For the third book, I went back to a place that we began visiting in the early 80s, and I talk about this in the preface a little. First time we were driving to Hatteras, it's in September of 81, I think. We're driving down Highway 12. We decided we were going to go past Nag's Head and continue on. The only place we knew of was the lighthouse. It's the only place you know of, the Hatteras Lighthouse. So where is the Hatteras Lighthouse? Well, it has to be in Hatteras Village, obviously. It's Hatteras. So we drive the length of the island, stay at a motel, wake up in the morning and realize, whoops, it's 15 miles behind
us. It. Right?
There are three villages closer to the lighthouse than Hatteras Village is. But we stayed and went back to that same motel every year for years.
You went back, even though it's 15 miles away from the lighthouse, you liked the motel.
Right.
Now, speaking of changes, can you still go back to that motel?
You can, but it's much diminished. It was whacked hard a few years ago by Hurricane Isabel. In fact, it was front page of many of the newspapers in the area, including the Norfolk paper. And I called down there. I called down a couple times through the years and talked to the lady who owns it, or one is in the owner's family, and we talked about it. And they weren't at that time weren't sure they were going to rebuild, and they did reopen one wing and remodel one wing. Their daughter was actually trapped in the hotel during the floodwaters of Isabel, a truly frightening situation. I mean, that was an awful hurricane. Any hurricane's a bad hurricane when it hits the island, but that was an awful one.
Well, you got a chapter on hurricanes and mm-hmm. storms, and the hurricane history didn't begin with that hurricane. I mean, we don't know when it began, but it apparently you can count on a very destructive hurricane coming regularly, maybe every 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 40 years. It's just you're going to get a wipeout hurricane.
Well, in fact, recorded history is dicey. I mean, there are references to hurricanes hundreds of years ago. The most notable old one was 1846, which actually cut the inlets that now form the northern and southern boundary of the island. So that sort of gave Hatteras its defining geography. And in fact, that the one that cut Hatteras Inlet at the south made Hatteras Village sort of the economic center of the island. It had not been until that point.
It became the sort of southern terminus of the of the island. And why did that make it? You'd think of it as being at the end of the island. It would be remote, rather than being the terminus.
For shipping purposes, and you could get inland to Washington, and there were various places that you now could get to. Hatteras is so remote. It's remote now, but historically it was very remote. This, of course, is long before there was a Bonner Bridge or a Highway 12 or any of that. In fact, I've got a chapter in there where I talk about Highway 12, and a lot of it is pre-Highway 12, where if you wanted to go down the island by car, it was very difficult. You would take a ferry, a little four-car ferry, across to the island. And then you would have to drive wherever you could. And the best place to drive was down near the water line. That's where the
tide goes out.
Right. Exactly. Now, when the tide came in, you couldn't drive down there. So you would have to go in the dunes. People were getting stuck or higher up. People were stuck all the time. Or you might have to drive more inland to the sound line. It was very tough going.
In the old days, I guess it would be, just solely by water that you go from mm-hmm. from village to village.
Right.
And the economic life in the old days, how did folks make a living?
Well, they scratched one out is what they did. I mean, this speaks to the Hatteras people, the hatteras nature, the hatteras soul. A lot of them were fishermen, some commercial fishing, a lot just fishermen, and they're independently
subsistence sort of fishing. Is that what it was?
That and maybe a little bit more. And the way they got goods often was very interesting. We talk about this a good deal. They often got them from shipwrecks, and there were a great many shipwrecks. So, director of the graveyard of the Atlantic Museum has a good quote. He says that when one of these ships would wash up ashore, it was like a Walmart washing ashore. All the goods that
it's
were suddenly there.
It's the cargo cult right? type of thing. They used to tell the story. I didn't find this in your book, but I might have just missed it. But it was that the prayer of a hatteras family was, "Dear God, we ask for you to protect the ships in the sea and those who have put themselves in danger, and watch over them. But Lord, if there should be, it should be determined that there should be a wreck, we pray that some of the goods would wash up on our shores."
Well, that'll be in the second edition. I like that quote. No, but that's sort of a theme. There's another quote along those lines, talking about the difficulties of the life there. Historically, there were life-saving stations that started appearing on the island in the late 1800s, 1880. And they would be every 6 or 7 miles. And these were the precursors to the Coast Guard. The U.S. life-saving station became the Coast Guard, formed with others. But one of their so-called blue book rules, as has been described, is the blue book, no matter what the weather, you had to go out and attempt a rescue. Even if you were likely to not succeed because the seas were so rough, as they often were, if there were a ship in trouble, you had to go out and attempt a rescue. And as they said, the blue book required you to go out. It didn't say anything about having to come back.
Well, we need to take a break. We're visiting with Ray McAllister about his latest book, Hatteras Island, Keeper of the Outer Banks. He and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome to Who's Talking. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Ray McAllister. Ray is the author of three books about coastal North Carolina, starting out with a great book on Topsail Island, then on Wrightsville Beach, and most recently on Hatteras Island we're talking about. It's just a special, I don't want to say it's a mystery, but there's a spiritualness of Hatteras Island that is infectious. It captures people's imagination. And you've tried to pull all of this together in a book. No way we'll cover everything. So what will we talk about? You mentioned earlier that raising the question of whether Hatteras and that part of the Outer Banks is really a part of North Carolina. It's way out there on a sandbar in the ocean, far right. out. And then another thing that sets the Hatteras Islanders apart is the Civil War. When the Civil War came, Hatteras Islanders
were an independent sort, weren't they?
Tell us the story of the attempt of to establish a loyal government of North Carolina Hatteras Island. It's kind of a neat story.
Right. The whole issue of Hatteras during the Civil War was interesting. The Hatteras people, by and large, not entirely, sided with the North. And in fact, they had gotten jobs through the federal government. The lighthouse had jobs and various other. So they had no real grudge against the North. And they were actually overrun by the North, but that was not a big issue. And in fact, when the Confederates came down, there's the famous Chickamauga races where
tell us that story. Yes,
well,
story.
It's hard to
visualize.
It's almost comical. We're not war. It would be comical, but the Confederates were actually with their mosquito fleet. Attack the island, try to...
This was the Union had occupied
right,
the island.
Union
and the
was
Confederates
then in control.
In the early part of the war, the Confederates said, we want to get it back.
Right. They had a live oak camp. They had a camp there, the Union Army did, and the Confederates, of course, were trying to regain the island and actually sent the Union Army running down the island.
Now, how did they do that?
Well, they came up on them with overpowering force. By
now, are they on the land? Are they?
They're largely in the water still. So that's the comical element. But the
so they're sailing up and down.
Right.
The sailboats are chasing the running soldiers.
Right.
Is that the race?
And. The Union army takes off running, literally on foot, running down toward where the lighthouse is.
With the idea that we are thinking of steamboats and all of this. This Mosquito fleet.
Oh, just very small boats. Right.
These are sailboats, I guess, mm-hmm. and rowboats, and so
right.
so I can outrun. The soldier says I can outrun this ship.
Well, it was their only chance. I mean, they had to get away, and of course, many of the residents went out with them too. Now the. It's funny because the Confederates' view on Hatteras residents was that they were opportunists. You know, if the Confederates came along, they were Confederate. If the Union came along, they were Union. They would put up the white flag for anybody. But you were talking about the government. After the Union secured the island, they set up on Hatteras what they claimed to be the government of North Carolina. Now, the rest of North Carolina would dispute that, but nonetheless, they claimed this was the government of North Carolina.
The loyal United States government.
Right, exactly. And they elected representatives to Congress, a representative who was not seated. Congress said, in fact, there's a good quote from the New York Times, which said that this was a mere sandbar. And that it's, I think the quote was something to the effect that it's like the tail wagging the dog for this to be the North Carolina government.
You'd have thought, or you might have expected, that they would have welcomed the opportunity to make something of the so-called fiction that North Carolina, that there were loyalists in North Carolina who, mm-hmm. who wanted to be, like the West Virginians or something like that.
Right.
That be part of
a sliver of loyalists.
A sliver of loyalists in North Carolina. The one of the many other chapters is one on peers, mm-hmm. and what we see there's a real sense of impending loss about the public peers. The peers along the North Carolina coast that are available to poor people like me, anybody could, in the old days at least, almost anybody who could get down there could fish off a pier, and they still can in the piers that remain, but as they wash away, they're not being replaced. What's the situation on the Outer Banks?
Well, on Hatteras, there are now three piers. They are somewhat irregular in design now. Through the years, they've been the tide shift, the sands shift, the piers shift, and they go up and down. And some of them are almost comical looking, but in an endearing way. And they look like roller coasters. I liken them to roller coasters.
You've got
coasters.
A great picture in there of a
right.
roller coaster pier.
Well, and they really are. I mean, they curve and they go up and down, and it's if you had a little car, you could run it on the thing. But no, it's a way of life that is. It'll be around for a while longer, but I'm not sure how much longer. It's there are economic dynamics at play, for one thing.
What are they, as best you can describe
well,
them?
Well, the coastal property is very valuable. It's just, it used to be, ironically enough, it used to be the least valuable land. I mean, you couldn't grow anything on it. It was shifting. It would disappear in 2 years. It wouldn't be there. But now, with people building on the coast, whether that's a good idea or not, they do, and it's the most valuable land. Actually, talked to a fellow who owns one of the piers on Topsail once, who said that his pier was worth $2.5 million. If he tore it down, it was worth $4 million.
Mm-hmm.
So that
makes
it the property.
Well,
we're
talking about the sort of sports fishing.
Mm-hmm.
The other part, which maybe even was a more important part of life on Hatteras, was the commercial fishing. And I guess the land values have had an impact on commercial fishing as well. What's the situation? I'll end this question quick in a minute, but I'm so worried about
Where are you going with this, DJ?
In the old days, Hatteras, if people were working, a lot of them were fishing.
Sure.
And there were fish houses that developed
right.
in Hatteras Village. If you go down there today, If you can find a fish house, it would be a miracle. What is there? Is fishing a sustainable occupation on the Outer Banks?
It is dwindling, and I've talked with a number of people in here and quoted others. There are commercial fishing regulations that have made it more difficult. The land is more valuable. A lot of the old-time fishermen feel they're being squeezed out, and they would never recommend their own children get into it. And it is a shame. Times change, places change, and nothing stays the same. But that's part of the culture, I think, that is being, if not lost, diminished.
Well, there was a couple of years ago I was involved in an effort to protect a fish house on Hatteras, and supposedly one of the, if not the sole remaining one, one of the very few that just wasn't sustainable in light of the feature that you described, that if you tore the fish house down for a condominium, it would be worth a whole lot more vacant was with a fish house on it. On the other hand, if you're a fisherman and you come in and there's no place to deposit your fish, you got to go all the way up to Manio or Wanchese to
And that's time and money.
That it's not economical. So what do these old fishing families do?
Yeah. Well, some have turned to tourism. I mean, tourism is now what fishing used to be, at least during the summer months, from let's say May through October. And In fact, a good many people who, and this gets to the Hatteras spirit, too. Many people who live on Hatteras will work two or three jobs during the summer just so they can afford to live there year round. Because in the winter, there's not much. I mean, it's a barrier island at sea, and it's cold, and it can be stormy, and restaurants aren't open, and it's a difficult life.
Yeah, on the other hand, you report in your book that some of the Hatteras people said they like it better, so much better in the off season because it's theirs again.
Exactly, and that cuts both ways. Some people move there and think, "Oh, I love this place. I'm going to stay here forever." And then they get their first winter and they're gone.
They're gone.
They can't
again.
Take it. Yeah. It can be a drubbing on the soul. But if you embrace that, it's liberating. I mean, you have the island to yourself and the few people you know. I've talked with people who will say in the winter they get out on the beach and they'll drive for miles, literally miles, and not see a soul.
Well, we're visiting with Ray McAllister about his latest book, Hatteras Island, Keeper of the Outer Banks. So we'll talk some more about Hatteras and the North Carolina seashore after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Ray McAllister has written books about the North is a Virginian, but has written a former columnist for the Big Richmond paper and now the editor of a magazine in Richmond, but for fun he comes to North Carolina, so we welcome him.
Well, thank you.
I want to be North Carolina.
You keep saying Virginia as if it's a bad word.
It is a good one. It's a good.
It's not the same as criminal.
I grew up 200 yards from the Virginia border, so I got nothing. I got nothing against Virginia at all. It's a great place, and in the early days, very helpful to us poor North Carolinians as we were trying to get our start. And one of the things that Virginia did for us, law-abiding North Carolinians in the colonial days, was to send down a party to help us get rid of our pirates.
Oh, that's right.
Governor of Virginia did what we couldn't do, and that great chapter about pirates in your book. And what did pirates, and we're in the context of a wonderful exhibit over at the North Carolina Museum of History in Raleigh on pirates, and the kids are into pirates. I don't know whether it's the Johnny Depp or the Pirates of the Caribbean or something, but there's this excitement about pirates, only cooled down a little bit by the awful fact that we're getting to know what piracy is really about in modern times off the coast of Somalia. So are we right to sort of romanticize the pirates and Hatteras?
Well, right is
whatever makes a buck.
Right, right. Well, you know, that's funny you should say that. My publisher, which is John F. Blair, publisher of Winston-Salem, we've got to put in a plug for him because they are a great publisher. But I was talking with the president once who said, if you want to sell a book, you on the cover you put pirates, ghosts, or lighthouses.
So, what a great!
By the way, guess what we've got on the cover.
I see a lighthouse on there.
Right, that's my wife took all the photographs. By the way, all the modern day photographs.
Yeah, well, you've got a great, lots of photographs in there, and mm-hmm. some recent, and some from the archives of right. the great history collections, mostly on the Outer Banks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, back to pirates. Don't sidestep that question. Good or bad?
Well, no, the Blackbeard actually was eventually killed down in Ocracoke Inlet through the auspices of the Virginia governor. And you're right. I mean, he is supposedly the North Carolina governor was in cahoots with, or at least turned a blind eye toward his deeds. And many people were put off by that and got the Virginia governor getting pirates did a terrible number on commercial shipping. I mean, these were people who were stealing ships and goods and killing people if they had to. And Blackbeard's was one of the most notorious. Now, as to the people on Hatteras, it's hard to say that Blackbeard ever actually landed on Hatteras. I've got a historian and talked with him at some length. It's hard to say. It's entirely plausible. He was certainly in the area. He certainly interacted with people from Hatteras. Hatteras people themselves were at no danger from the pirates. I mean, pirates weren't interested in lowly fishermen on Hatteras Island. I mean, they were not a concern. They were after the foreign ships. I mean, that's what they were after. So, but no, pirates have become a part of mythology, a part of lore, and they have been romanticized, though I don't think all of them are Johnny Depp or, and Blackbeard, by all accounts, was a harsh, brutal, could be terrifying man.
Part of your book is about, with a remote connection, perhaps, to modern piracy, is this ghost ship of Diamond Shoals. And we're familiar mm-hmm. with that story, which is so nicely told as a chapter in your book, but our own Bland Simpsons mm-hmm. wrote a really fine book combining the facts and
right.
fiction, docudrama.
Docudrama,
yeah. I mean, it's based on fact, but in order to piece the story together, some of it was from right. Bland's imagination. But nevertheless, so we're familiar with that story, and mm-hmm. I want you to tell part of it because there were suspicions of piracy on this lost ship.
There were suspicions of everything, right? It was a funny
story.
This was
in relatively speaking, it was in modern times. It was
1921.
A sailing ship,
right? A large five-masted schooner.
What is best you can tell you?
Well, it suddenly one morning the Coast Guard lookout is looking out and sees a five-masted schooner, which is a very large sailing ship, sails all set, meaning full speed ahead, on the shoals, just grounded on the shoals. And the weather was bad, and it took several days before they could actually get on board, the rescuers could get on board, and they found nobody. There was no sign of anybody. And the mystery remains to this day. You know how a lot of mysteries are sort of faked? They're not really mysteries. There's an explanation. Well, there are many theories, but there's no certainty.
Nobody can
figure
it out.
No, I mean, mutiny is one speculation. A bad storm, pirates, Bolsheviks.
What happened is that the ship, when the rescuers got there, the ship is there intact. It's stuck, and
right,
eventually
sure.
it falls apart. But upon discovery, there's this ship. And everybody's gone. The whole crew is gone, and like the lost colonists, you just never found them again.
There was food set out as if to prepare for a meal. The captain's records. Now, interestingly, his log, the handwriting changed a few days or weeks before this event. There were three sets of shoes in his captain's quarters. So it's this, you suspected maybe mutiny or pirates or the only thing they found on it was a cat. There was a cat on board, but everything else was gone. there was no distress signal. There was no indication that anything was amiss. There was a the ship did pass a light ship on down the coast and signal that everything was okay, but it seemed odd to the man who spotted them. It seemed to be not the captain on board on the deck. The federal government, five departments of the federal government investigated this. In fact, Herbert Hoover led the investigation. And they never could figure it out. And they had different suppositions. And all of them seemed plausible, but all of them had holes in them.
Never figured it out.
No, and there's a fascinating... If you go down to the graveyard of the Atlantic Museum down in Hatteras Village, they display this quite nicely.
One of the things that interested me, this was a sailing ship in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, golly, you know, we'd had steamboats mm-hmm. For a long time. What in the world... Have you got a commercial sailing vessel out there again
mm-hmm.
that as recently as less than 100 years ago, people
sure.
were making found it more efficient to use the wind mm-hmm. than to use some sort of engine, coal?
They were green ahead of their time.
Yeah, they're green ahead of their time. Well, let's take a quick break. We're visiting with Ray McAllister about his book, Hatteras Island, Keeper of the Outer Banks, and we'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Ray McAllister is my guest. We're talking about his book about Hatteras Island. It's called Hatteras Island, Keeper of the Outer Banks. It's newly published by John F. Blair, the great publishers of so many great North Carolina books. And like those books, Hatteras Island is available in, I think, in every local bookstore and the national chains and online.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't, you can surely order it from Blair if you can't
right.
find it someplace else.
Either blairpub.com or raymcallister.com.
Yeah, you yourself have got a great website, which we'll link on our website.
Excellent. Thank you.
www.raymcallister, all one word, McAllister's, or raymcallister.com. And more about Hatteras Island. This new book, and also about the book about Topsail and the book about Wrightsville. So, on all of these coastlines that you've examined, we have the question of what's the best thing to do to protect these beaches, to protect the property of people who've invested large sums of money building houses and,
you know, see,
and hotels.
That's a hot issue. So
well,
no matter how you answer that, you're in trouble with somebody.
Well, of course, well, you are, and
I is the issue.
No, my I better not go there. But yeah, it is it's a big issue. But you talk about it in your book,
right,
so I know
sure.
you're willing to talk about it. Yeah, I'm sure you'll be discreet in talking about it. But the way you talk about it, which is very interesting, is that you've got this very important highway that links Hatteras Island with the rest of the world,
mm-hmm.
and through the Bonner Bridge. But if you can cross the Bonner Bridge, and if Highway 12 is not there, you're back 100 years, and you got to drive
sure,
on the beach.
Sure.
And when these hurricanes come and go, very often the highway it's either washed out or washed over.
Mm-hmm.
And what you report in your book is that the scientists have changed their minds about what to
right,
do. What is
right.
the best thing to do about preserving the beaches? Excuse me for just quoting back your book to you, but this was all instructive.
Is that
to me.
In here? I'll have to read it.
Yeah,
it sounds good.
It's really good. It's really good stuff. But that the scientist, the conservationist, in the 30s determined that the best thing to preserve the beaches is to preserve the dunes, build up the dunes,
mm-hmm.
build up things
right.
to collect sand,
right.
and then plant the dunes. That makes lots of sense to me.
Right, it does.
But it does
on one hand, and on the other hand, you can see.
But they've changed their minds, haven't they?
Sure, they have. Well, the dunes were constructed and worked. I mean, the dunes did what they were supposed to do. Now, there's also the notion, if you think about barrier islands, they're not intended to be stationary. They're out there to absorb storms. They take the impact of storms and current and waves and winds and protect the mainland. And they move. They shift. They mostly shift westward and southward. And they break apart. They reform. Inlets open.
They're
inlets
dynamic.
They are. They are not stationary. It's not like Kansas.
Or at least not naturally.
Right, right.
But man has shown that he can stabilize sometimes.
That's the issue. If you come and you put expensive property, buildings, development on an island, what do? If you leave it to nature, eventually you lose those developments, that house, that lighthouse. I mean, that was another issue. The lighthouse was moved.
Yeah, we should have talked about the lighthouse.
Well, 1999, 10 years ago, we came up on 10th anniversary. That was a very controversial move. It doesn't seem so in retrospect. It seems to have been the right move, but it was certainly very controversial at the time.
Well, the greatest... on the cover of your book, we got the Hatteras Lighthouse, and I've avoided talking about it. And it's one of the great signal experiences of my life to climb the old lighthouse 15 years ago, the last time. And now, as you point out in your book, it has been successfully moved. Many of us didn't think it could be done. It's set, and now it's available in the summertime or in season that we can go climb up it again, and I'm sure it's still a great experience.
I did that last summer for this book and described it. It's an experience, and it's not particularly, if you're short-winded or if you don't like tight quarters, I might advise against it.
It's an adventure.
But it's a terrific, when you get to the top, it's worth it.
All right, that puts in context the argument about whether or not properties that are adjoining a disappearing beach should be sacrificed to let the nature take its course. And you've written very discreetly about this, but where is this all going?
Check back with me in 100 years. I mean, I think it'll be a continuing issue. After every storm, in fact, we've got great photos in there, but they parts of Highway 12 are covered in sand, and you have to shovel out, and you've got a canyon of sand on either side. The highway has been moved four or five times to the mainland side, to the west. I'm trying to keep you some west straight. These are dynamic islands, and the highway department basically has maintained the dunes as a way of maintaining Highway 12. If you don't have the dunes, you probably can't have Highway 12. Now, if you don't have Highway 12, then you can't really have transportation up and down the island, at least not in any practical sense. Yet, that is how the island was naturally, and these are just continuing arguments, as is the new controversy over beach access. Used to be you could drive on Hatteras on the beach, with very few restrictions, and people on Hatteras often don't like to have restrictions, and there are now many restrictions, and there have been lawsuits over it, and that's a continuing battle.
Going back to the point that you made earlier on about why Hatteras is different from Nag's Head, and one of those is the establishment of the National Seashore, which, notwithstanding how complex this issue is, does make it easier to manage it as a dynamic arena.
Sure.
But we're getting ready to spend millions, billions of dollars on the Bonner Bridge reconstruction, which is the link to this highway. It would be heresy to say, but somebody from a far distance would say, why in the world are you guys spending all this money to give access to a region that should be left without access so that it can do its job as nature intended it to do?
Well, ask the developers what they think. No, there are all these things are issues, and I've never written about a place with as many issues as Hatteras has. Mm-hmm. And I think there are well-intended people with good arguments on both sides of a lot of these issues. But I tell you, everything is sort of an issue on Hatteras. And I think maybe that's what you get when you get such a singular place. I mean, this is a wonderful place. I would argue unequaled. I've never seen a place quite like Hatteras. It's beautiful and it's wild at the same time. A lot of people have been there for a while now are upset by what they see as encroaching development, and it is encroaching. But I've written books about places like Wrightsville where there's far more development than Hatteras. I mean, if you go just north to the Nag's Head, Kill Devil Hills, Kitty Hawk area, there's much more. We actually put a photograph in this book of the new wings in Avon, because it's so striking, and I don't mean necessarily in a positive fashion.
The new wings in Avon?
Right.
What is it? What are you talking about?
It's a t-shirt souvenir.
The new shop that's at every beach place, but you wouldn't maybe
right.
it wouldn't.
There are a couple small ones on Hatteras Island, but there's a large one. Now, if you go up north, of course, they're every two blocks, but... I make the case that it
there's
may
a Walmart,
be
the, or there's a Food Lion and a Wings.
Well, I make the case that the new Wings may be the second most significant structure on the island now, behind only the lighthouse.
Well, there's so much more to talk about in your wonderful book, Hatteras Island, Keeper of the Outer Banks. Ray McAllister is the author. He's traveling around promoting the book, so keep your eye open. You might be able to meet him. You can certainly get the book in almost every one of the bookstores nearby Chapel Hill.
Right.
If not, you can order it online.
Hardcover and paperback, by the way.
Hardcover, and you can order it, of course, from online source. And check Ray's own website for more information about the book. It's www.raymcallister.com, and we'll have a link to that on our WCHL website. Ray, thanks so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Me too. Thanks to all y'all for listening. I'll be back right here, same time tomorrow.